Upgrade your laundry routine with a durable and reliable Maytag laundry pair at Lowe's. Like the new Maytag washer and dryer with performance-enhanced stain-fighting power designed to cut through serious dirt and grime. And what's great is this laundry pair is in stock and ready for delivery when you need it the most. Don't miss out. Shop Maytag in-store or online today at Lowe's.
Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullen.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
To Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton, and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Coming up on today's show, Lego, the popular children's toy, is also one of the world's most successful and nimble businesses. And today we look at the economics of the beloved building blocks. We ask, do we really understand capital gains tax, particularly as we're approaching tax deadlines? Plus, Roadkill, a new book that looks at our complicated relationship with the automobile. You can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on social media at Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, I'm going to start off this week with an explainer of what an open economy means, as Ireland is often described as such. Well, first off, I'm going to explain what a closed one is, because that makes it easier. So a closed economy is one that doesn't buy anything from abroad, which is always called importing, or sell anything abroad, and that's called exporting. So an open economy is simply the opposite. It's one that has a lot of imports and exports. So next time you hear that Ireland is an open economy, you know that it simply means we buy a lot of goods and services from outside the country. Now, in a country often described as one of the highest taxed in Europe, Ireland's 33% capital gains tax stands out, especially when you compare it to notoriously high tax countries like Belgium. And they're only starting to introduce it. So what exactly are we taxing and why? With the income tax deadline approaching, we're taking a closer look now at how Ireland treats investment gains and whether we're getting it right. Joining me to discuss this is Mairead O'Driscoll, better known as the Tax Nerd, to help unpack the world of capital gains tax. Now, Mairead, in the US, individuals in the top 0.1% of income distribution represent half of all the net capital gains. And the percentage is 30% in Canada. Can you tell us, how is capital gains tax actually designed by governments, and what's it supposed to achieve?
Ultimately, obviously, it's to collect taxes for the government, like along with the rest of the taxes, but it's a tax on capital assets. So it's not a tax on your income, a regular income that's coming in. It's literally just to try capture the growth and value that people have in their investments. So that's essentially what it's for.
And if I go back there to the numbers that I just referred to, is it the case that generally people who pay capital gains tax are going to be among the higher earners, because higher earners have the money to invest in assets and thus would be taxed?
Yes, yes. Typically, I think most of the receipts from CGT are related to the wealthier kind of side of the house, essentially. And the capital gains tax in Ireland, anyway, is more suitable for those individuals because it is a lower rate than income tax rates. So in some countries, they tax all assets, all gains at income tax rates, which are usually higher than the capital gains tax rates. So it can be beneficial for a certain cohort of people. But on the other hand, for maybe the middle class or normal, let's say, you know, it is quite a hit to take, and people kind of hold on to investments a bit longer, then are kind of less inclined to maybe even invest in the first place because of it.
I definitely want to talk about who's paying capital gains tax in Ireland today, if we look into it a bit more deeper, because I looked at an OECD report and it said, if you look at the earnings of the top 1% in the UK, of the people who are paying capital gains tax, the top 1% of income earners in the UK, then you include capital gains tax in that income, the newly counted in the top 1% are most likely to be business owners, older and female. So who are the people listening to us today, do you think, need to make sure that they're on the right side of capital gains tax, particularly if they're not sure if we're talking about them or not?
Absolutely. And the first one I'd say that to say to that are people that might not be aware of people who get company shares. So you have a capital gains tax obligation. So just to take a step back, capital gains tax, as I said, is a tax on capital assets. So included in that is shares, property, any type of assets, cryptocurrency, anything that you have that holds value, essentially, rather than your day-to-day income, is a capital asset, and you dispose of it, you're subject to capital gain tax on that. So if you got issued shares in work, and while it might feel, because it's in work, if you're an employee, it might feel that you don't have any obligations, you absolutely do. If you sell those shares, that is a capital disposal, and you have to, if you make a gain, pay capital gains tax on that.
Okay, but in that case, so Mairead, let's say that I get shares, let's say that they're worth something, right? Yeah. Because they may not always be, but let's say that they're worth something.
Yes.
And then I sell them. Why would I be paying capital gains tax and not income tax if they're simply part of my income?
Well, okay, sorry. So that depends now. Employee shares are a bit complicated. However, if you get given shares for free from your company, you are subject to income tax on the market value of the shares, right?
So let's say that they're worth 100 euros each and I have 10 of them and now I have 1,000 euro, let's say.
Yeah, so that 1,000 euro, when you get given the shares, let's say for free from your company, you're taxed as if you received 1,000 euro income, right? Mm-hmm. So you're taxed. So that's one element. So you own those shares now, do what you like. In a year's time, they grow to 2,000 euro. So you sell them and you've made a gain of 1,000 euro. Now, this is probably a bad example, actually, because there is a 1,270 euro exemption for everyone. So it's an annual exemption. So if you make a gain less than 1,270, you don't have to pay any tax on that. It's anything over that that you're paying CGT on.
Okay, so and I do want to delve in a little bit more into that. For anybody who's old enough to remember, of which I am, that 1,270 euro is an easy number to remember because it was an old 1,000 pounds. One Irish punt was worth 127, and that's where that number comes from. So we'll say independent of where somebody gets the money, they invest in shares, let's say.
Yeah.
Then they make a gain, and then the first 1,270 euros of that is then tax-free before they pay any other taxes. Do people share that with their spouse, for example? Is it like a tax partner or is that just for an individual?
It's per person, yeah. So it's okay. For an individual. Now, you can't pass it on. If one spouse doesn't use it, they can't give it to the other spouse. It is your own individual exemption. And just to bear in mind, the 1,270 is the gain value, not the tax value. So you're saving 400 euro, about 420 euro tax on that, just to get that distinction, because some people calculate their tax bill, let's say it's 5,000, and then they take the 1,270 off the tax bill. That's not right. It's the gain, so it's not as valuable as you might think.
That's a really important point, actually. So,
yeah.
And just to distinguish what you're saying there, if somebody makes 5,000 euro of a gain, they take the 1,270 off that before applying the 33% tax.
Correct.
As distinct to calculating 33% and then saying, oh, this is great, I don't have to pay the 1,270 of that. So, yeah, an important distinction. Now, this is great, Nalmarid, but what if you lose money? So if you make money, of course, there's a gain. But if you lose money, what happens then in terms of tax treatment?
So if you are meant to declare everything, even if you make a gain or a loss, okay? Obviously, there's no interest or penalties because you don't owe any tax. However, I highly recommend everyone gets into the habit of making sure you file a tax return to declare your losses, because you can then use those losses to offset any future gains. So in this year, if you sold your shares and you made a loss of 1,000 euros, you file your tax return, you don't owe anything on it. And then next year you make a gain of 2,000 euro, you can carry forward that 1,000 euro and knock it off the gain you make in future years. So it's very important to track it.
And when you say file a return, what specific form are we talking about?
So you can include it in your Form 11 tax return when you're self-employed, or you can include it, there's on your ROS, your PAYE, there's a capital gains element you can include it in. So it depends whether you're a PAYE or non-PAYE taxpayer, or there's a separate CG1 form. Three options, really. Just to bear in mind, the date you are required to file your tax return is different to the date you have to pay the CGT. So that's important for people. So if you dispose of your asset between January and November, you have to pay the CGT by the 15th of December. So that can be a quite quick turnaround. So we're in October now. So if you sell from now or in next month, even in November, you've only a few weeks to pay the CGT. So it's important to just bear that in mind, because separately, the actual filing of the return isn't due until next year. So the year October of the year after you sold.
So what I'm hearing there is step one is to determine what form you need to fill out first, whether it's Form 11 if you're self-employed, the ROS, the form on ROS if you're registered on ROS, and then there's another form as well, the CG1.
Yeah.
The second thing is make sure you've got your deadlines right between filing a return and paying it, and then the third thing is make sure you pay the right amount, of course, as well.
Yeah.
Now, we have so far talked about something like stocks, but if we look at something like property, property, of course, is less liquid. And what I mean by that is if I want to sell a share, I can push a button on a stockbroking account and then, assuming that there's shares available, which for the vast majority of stocks there are, it'll be sold. Property is different. So are there any specific rules related to capital gains tax when it comes to property, Mairead?
No, it's the exact same way that you're calculating it. It's taking the sales less the cost you paid for it. Now, if you bought the house before 2003, there is indexation relief. Now that stopped after 2003. So to kind of capture the inflation impact, unfortunately that's gone now. So obviously inflation is huge, but you get no relief for that unless your property was bought in 2003 or before 2003, I should say. The other thing with property is there are reliefs out there. So if it's your main residence, your home that you've lived in, there's principal private residence relief, and you've never lived anywhere else, then you can get nearly full CGT relief. So that's important for people. The period of ownership, if for 2 years of your life you worked somewhere else, then it's prorated the relief you get. But for property homeowners, there is relief for that.
Okay, so when it comes to property, what you need to consider is, first of all, was the property bought before 2003, and then check into indexation relief.
Yeah.
And then apart from that, as you say, there's other nuances to it, like if you lived abroad, etc. And then just for completeness, because I want to move on to funds, for completeness, is it that the same thing applies for cryptocurrency or art or wine or handbags? Like, is capital gains tax uniformly then apply to any other type of asset?
Absolutely. Yeah. Whether, as I said, whether it's a house or cryptocurrency, then if you're disposing of an asset, it's 33% on a gain.
Okay. So there was a change, of course, in the budget this year, in budget 2026. So I'm just going to read out what it was, and then you might explain to us, Mairead, first of all, what does it mean and why is it different to anything we've been talking about so far? So the tax rate for Irish domiciled investment funds and equivalent offshore funds have been reduced from 41% to 38% as of budget 2026. So what's the impact of that?
So this is where this is a tax you pay on gains from investing in funds. So when you invest in a fund, that's investing in loads of different shares or whatever. It's not you individually owning the asset. And the tax on that is 41%. So it's typically life insurance funds or any kind of fund pools that you're investing in. And so that's obviously a lot higher than the 33% rate. And there has been a full kind of fund sector review going on with the Department of Finance to kind of look at this and see kind of Ireland's competitiveness in this area. And obviously there's an inequity there with the 41% and the 33%. So there's been a lot of lobbying to get that reduced. And when lots of people are lobbying for it to be reduced down to 33% to be in line with other investments, this is welcome that it's slightly reduced at least to 38%. So actually the finance bill was out today. We don't know the actual details of it yet. We think it'll be from 1 January next year. So if you have a life insurance fund, the tax on that will now be 38% versus 41%. Or if you invest in any kind of open fund platform.
Or what about exchange traded funds? Would they be, they fall in under the same one? Okay, but do the other rules apply? Like, I can offset my loss against my gains. I only make a gain when I sell. Anything else like that that we need to watch out for?
No, losses. You can't get loss relief in these funds. Unfortunately, that's another area that is kind of coming up in the fund review to see if they can look at that and see how that would work. So you get no loss relief, and there's also a deemed disposal. So you, even though you might not sell anything in the fund, every 8 years you're deemed to have done so, and you pay a tax. Now you get a credit when you finally do exit. However, every 8 years there is a deemed disposal. Again, that's being pushed to get rid of.
Of course, Mairead, we have the tax nerd here with us, so let's talk about tax minimization strategies, right? So first of all, if I was to simply set up a company and then I buy whatever I'm going to buy. Now, obviously, I'd want to have a lot of assets in order to make this worth my while, but I'm going to buy whatever I buy and then I'm going to sell it. And then would I simply pay 12.5% of my 12.5% on that then, because I would buy it through a company instead of buying it through an individual? Would that work?
No. Unfortunately not. Companies are subject to CGT at 33% as well. Now, it's under corporation tax, as in that you do a regross of the amount, but no, unfortunately not. That's not it. That's not a get out, unfortunately.
Plan B, right? let's try something else here. What about pensions? Tell us what happens in terms of CGT when it comes to putting money in your pension.
Now, that is efficient. So the government want us to put money into our pensions. So to do so, they make it tax efficient. So essentially, when you put money into your pension, or you, firstly, it goes in, you get tax relief. It then grows tax-free. So the money being invested in your pension fund grows tax-free throughout the life of the fund. And then at exit, when you retire and actually draw down the money, there's more tax relief. So a certain amount is tax-free. And you can kind of, say, manage the amount you get in the year to maybe not go into the higher income tax thresholds. So for example, if you had €1,000 you wanted to invest and you didn't need it, so €1,000 buying €1,000 of shares, if that grows to 10 grand, you'll pay 33% on 9 grand. Versus if you put that 1 grand in your pension and it grows to 9 grand, you won't pay any tax except the income tax at the end, as I said, though, that has relief incorporated into it as well.
Mm-hmm. Like, that's the thing, is that there is so, the opportunity for tax management through a pension is really striking.
Absolutely.
Just one last thing I want to ask you, because I started off by comparing us to Belgium, to comparing us to the US, to comparing us to the UK. Do you think that such a high tax rate disincentivizes people to invest in assets? Like, this isn't just about the stock market, like we were saying. It's also, does it act as a disincentive to any asset, given the high rate of tax?
Absolutely. And I think it, particularly in the small family businesses, you know, there's no incentive to hand over the reins if they're going to be hit with 33% tax. So I think there has been a lobbying as well to get that reduced down to even 20%. I do think in Ireland, though, in terms of investing, we're not as good at it in Ireland. I don't know why. I think we're getting better. I think with the likes of Revolut and platforms like that making it easier, and the fact people kind of have to now, you know, you're not getting the return that you usually would, maybe, or definitely not in a bank, you know, I think, and people are getting more probably educated in the area as well, that which is helpful to do it and not be afraid. But I do think tax does disincentivize people, especially, as I said, small family businesses, and homes maybe as well. Maybe homes that need to be redeveloped, if they lower the rate there, maybe potentially that could help.
And all the more reason, Marie, though, to build our tax literacy as well. And certainly you've helped that for all Taking Stock listeners this morning. Thank you so much indeed for joining me, Marie O'Driscoll, better known as the Tax Nerd, to help unpack the world of capital gains tax. Thanks so much indeed for joining me.
No problem. Thank you.
This is Susan A's Culleton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we look at the incredible business story that is Lego. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan A's Culleton. And now for this week's economic trivia question. Well, last week I had a real honour of hosting or emceeing a global conference showcasing industry clusters right across the island of Ireland. Now, here are my two questions for you. First, how many hotel bedrooms are available across the full island of Ireland? And second, which is longer, the Wild Atlantic Way or the Great Ocean Road in Australia? I'll tell you the answers at the end of the show. Now, from a small workshop in Billund, Denmark, to one of the most beloved companies in the world, the Lego Group has built a story as remarkable as the creations it inspires. What started with wooden toys and a simple idea, the company's maxim, only the best is good enough, has grown into a global brand, sparking creativity for children and adults alike. Now, Emil Persson, in-house writer for Quarter's Edge magazine, joins me now to explore how Lego turned imagination into a lasting business and cultural icon. So, first off, Emil, you're very welcome. And as I think of Denmark, first of all, I think of Novo Nordisk, I think of the Netflix series Bergen, which I really enjoyed, and I think of happy people with great public services. How is Danish culture infused into the Lego Group, do you think?
Yeah, thank you for having me. I lived in Copenhagen for a number of years, so I feel like I have some insights to give on this. But I feel like Danish culture and Lego really go hand in hand. I mean, there is a lot of focus on creativity, especially for children. So learning through play and really giving children the tools to learn on their own and to create what they call productive play. So, and that just really melds together with what Lego is about. And like you said, you mentioned Novo Nordisk here. One of the things about Lego that I think is so interesting and really admirable is how it really is a beloved company back in its home country. I mean, you have these massive companies such as Novo Nordisk or Carlsberg, and while they're very impressive, they're not something that sparks national pride in a way that a company like Lego does. So I really feel that Danish culture is infused into Lego in a way that is very, very pronounced. And it has been that way for since its founding, more or less.
And what about Hygge?
About Hygge, yes. It's a very popular word, and it's been going around, a bit of a buzzword. But Hygge really boils down to doing things that are cozy. It's a bit difficult to translate, but doing something sort of arts and craft, or, you know, during long Danish winters, you might bundle up on the couch and watch a movie. That is Hygge. But it could also be doing something with the family. So for example, you could get a new Lego set and you could spend a Friday evening building it together. And that would also classify as Hygge.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, I was in Denmark twice actually. And it's a word that I kept seeing everywhere. So as we started our conversation today, I wanted to get a real sense of how Denmark is is really in the business as well as in the product. But I'd like to bring our listeners through a chronological story today. And so if we go back to the beginning, the company began in the early 30s, but it took 15 years until an inflection point happened. In 1946, Ole Kirk Christiansen attended a showcase of a new type of plastic injection molding machine in Copenhagen. And then in 1949, the first plastic product was reaped with small interlockable cubes. So while it began with wood and moved on to plastic, how important was that shift then, which was happening over those 15 to 20 years?
I mean, the change from plastic was, I don't think that they knew it back then, but it was absolutely crucial in allowing Lego to grow. Just like you said, the first plastic products that they produced became sort of the predecessor to the Lego brick that we know and love today. What was really interesting about this was that they were the first in Denmark to start exploring this relatively new and unproven concept, which was plastic. Whereas it also allowed them to do all of these new things that wood simply didn't allow for them to do. And it's, you know, today it doesn't sound very groundbreaking to start making toys with plastic, but back then it was an absolute game changer. And it sort of allowed them to then build on as they moved, specifically through the 1950s. It really allowed them to expand and to grow their product portfolio.
I think we really need to underscore that point for our listeners, is that, like, this was, as you say, new and unproven. This was a really big risk, a really, really big one. And as we move into the 50s, I want to set the scene here. In 1955, the Cold War was in full swing. Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat and Albert Einstein died. But Emil, what happened in 1955 for a Lego?
In 1955, they introduced the Lego system in play, and this is, as the name suggests, it is a system, but it was incredibly groundbreaking for the time because it brought cohesion and structure to play. So, for example, before the system was introduced, you might buy your child a wooden fire truck. And, you know, here you have it, and then you leave them to their own devices. But what the Lego system in play was, it introduced products that fit together in a cohesive way. So the first was sort of a miniature town that was filled with a bunch of buildings and people and cars. And all of these you could play with for themselves, but they also fit together in a cohesive way, allowing the child to really play on their own terms. And that was completely revolutionary at the time, because yes, creativity is one of the key guiding principles of Lego, but this really allowed children to explore that in sort of a guided format. And another really interesting thing about the Lego system at play was, remember, this was introduced in the middle of the 50s, but it was marketed to both boys and girls at the same time. So it was specifically a unisex product back in the 1950s, and that was not very, very common. So both boys and girls were used in marketing materials and things like that.
So we're about, at this point, about 25 years into the business. And before I go on, I'd just like to point out the fact, of course, that, to say something very obvious, 25 years is a long time, but there's a generation in that. Like, the Lego Group is a family business. And up until now, we'll say, if we were just to take the numbers at the moment, it's generating around about 10 billion a year in revenue. And of course, that is Danish krona, is the home currency. And yet, it's a family business, has decided not to list on the stock market, but yet publish an annual report. Can I ask, how has the family dynamic influenced the company's development over the past, where are we at now, almost 100 years?
Yeah. I mean, I believe that it has been incredibly important, simply because, I mean, as you know, and as the listeners are going to be aware of, being a family-run business comes with a host of both pros and cons. But I believe that in this case, it has really allowed Lego to continue being Lego throughout all of these years. They're able to really focus on what they believe is the best for the company over long term. I mean, currently they're undergoing a lot of different sustainability projects. So they're trying to make all of their products a bit better for the environment. And this is a process that's taking around 15 years. And they're choosing to do so because the family and the management believe it's the right thing to do. And perhaps not because it's going to push profits for the next quarter report. So I believe that having the family ownership structure has been absolutely crucial to allow LEGO to focus on what it believes is right, while also not losing sight of the long-term perspective. So they're not trying to chase the newest fads, and they're not trying to expand beyond what they know and what they do best.
Well, let me challenge that a little bit, because in the 1960s, perhaps they'd had to look at what they were doing and actually say, well, maybe there's things we need to stop doing, because in 1960, they decided to move away from the wooden toys and go full on, all in, into the plastic miniatures. So up until the 1960s, they were growing, they were starting, they were doing things, doing what they were doing well, as you were saying, all of the things you've just said there. What do you think led to them deciding, hold on, now we need to stop and think about what we need to respectively stop doing?
Yeah, I mean, again, it was a crisis that led them to doing this, because there was a factory fire again in the 1960s that burnt down the wooden toys, that section that they had, and that allowed them to be, well, okay, now we don't have a wooden toy factory anymore, and the Lego system in play with the new Lego bricks are really, really taking off, and we're going to focus on doing that. Because that also allowed them to stand out, and they were seeing that the Lego system in play combined with the interlocking bricks was incredibly popular, and children and consumers were loving it, and that they were able to simply refocus and to hone in on what they were doing better than anyone else, or they were the only ones doing it. So
to a degree, this actually was taken out of their hands, almost literally. The whole idea of stopping doing something, if something burns down, then of course the conversation is, okay, do we leave it that way or do we pursue a different path? So then they decided, right, we're going to go all in on the plastic side of things, which is and has continued until what we know today. I would like to ask you, Emil, about risk, because risk isn't always about things going wrong. It sometimes is when things go better than you can handle. And I want to move on to Legoland now, because the first year of Legoland, it had over 600,000 visitors, and that was over double what the company had hoped for. How adaptable do you think the Lego Group is to when demand is much higher than expected, whether it's with that example or any other?
I mean, I believe that Lego has become very, very good at managing risk. But they're also incredibly diversified in a way that you might not think of immediately. I mean, they have around, I believe it's 800 different box sets out now, and half of these were new. But that also means that they're able to very quickly shift away from things that are not working, and to then, so for example, say that they have a new licensing agreement with an IP sort of like a new video game that has come out, and they introduce 10 box sets, and they see, okay, these are selling out very, very quickly. They can then quickly lean into that, and they can perhaps double the amount of box sets that they have available. But it also allows them to very quickly to shave off areas that are not performing as well.
Now, you just brought up a point there that I have to explore with you, and that is digital, because any time that I've interacted with Lego, it has been very much in a physical realm. How has Lego adapted, or then maybe unadapted, to the digital developments that we've seen in the past 30 years?
They've adapted to them incredibly well, because I mean they have such a strong brand. You pick 100 people on the street, 99 of them are going to know what Lego is, if not even 100. But this has also allowed them to really go beyond physical. So for example, I think that there are a lot of people now who perhaps their latest interaction with Lego was seeing a Lego movie or playing a Lego video game or something along those lines. And that, again, also speaks to the risk and the diversification that is within the company. So they're producing TV shows and they're producing movies and they're part of video games. So they have really been able to adapt to the digital world, whereas, perhaps other toy companies are not able to do so in a similar manner, simply because their brand and their products are that well known and that loved.
We've talked a lot about what has gone right for the business, apart from the fire, but I'd like to also talk about what didn't, because in 2004, the company was facing serious financial crisis due to overexpansion, a cooling toy market, and a plethora of operational inefficiencies. And how do they handle that?
They handled that by making what I can only assume was a pretty tough decision for the family, but what ultimately was the right decision. So they brought in a new CEO, the first CEO who was not part of the family, and they really shaved off a lot of unneeded products. So they really tried to refocus, but they then also leaned quite heavily into licensed sets. So for example, they had released the first Lego Star Wars sets 5 years earlier, but they then really leaned into that, and then combined with other popular licensed releases, it sort of allowed them to get back on the right course. So today, like we mentioned, the company is chaired and technically still owned by the family, but they now have a CEO from the outside. So,
and if we could just stay with the modern day, then while the company is born out of creativity, can I ask you about its engagement with community? Can you tell us about the concept of Lego Ideas?
I can, and this is actually something that, you know, the regular person might not know that much about. And if you just buy Lego for your kids or something, but Lego has a huge adult following today. So the Lego Ideas is it's a concept that Lego has had in it's been available from Lego now for a number of years. And what it is that anybody can send in an idea that you might have. So for example, you can build a treehouse and send it in. And if it gets enough votes and garners enough support, Lego can then choose to make it into an actual box set that they then sell.
And it's interesting there then that you said that they have 800 box sets, but many of them are new. I mean, they're very effective at getting ideas from literally grounded being in the market. Emil Persson, in-house writer for Quarter's Edge magazine, thank you very much for that fascinating trip back through history and particularly focusing on the Lego group. Thanks so much indeed for joining us here on Taking Stock.
Thank you very much.
This is Susan A's Culleton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we ask if it's time to kill the car. Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan A's Culleton. So, do you love your car? And could you do without it? Well, if you answered yes to the first question and no to the second, you might want to pay particular attention to this conversation. Arthur Kay is the co-author of Unveiling the True Cost of Our Toxic Relationship with Cars, a book that pulls no punches when it comes to looking at our relationship with the machine that often gives us a va-va-voom feeling. In chapter one, Arthur, you set out a pretty stark stall. You say today the total stands at one car for every five people. That's roughly 1.6 billion cars for a global population of 8.1 billion people. And you mention 1 billion of those cars are in cities. You say cars directly or indirectly cause 1 out of 34 deaths annually, and in aggregate have been the reason for more deaths than both of the world wars combined. However, one of the key premises that you make is that you feel we have been made car dependent as governments have prioritised cars over people. Will you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a really important point to draw out that we're not explicitly anti all cars everywhere all the time. So the car can be an amazing invention and can be incredibly useful. But what's happened in reality is that we've become dependent on cars and locked into certain lifestyles that make us dependent on cars. So we're really not free from the car. We're constrained by it a lot of the time. And also critically, if I was to kind of announced to you now that I'd come up with a machine that was going to kill millions of people each year, that was going to indirectly cause the death of millions more, and also going to be the biggest single emitter of air pollution, of light pollution, of noise pollution, of of various other kinds of negative impacts, you'd say, well, please do not create that invention. But it's snuck up on us, and we argue in the book that we can still use the car, but we need to do it on our terms rather than let it do whatever it wants to do.
Can I pick up, Arthur, on the point you make about freedom versus constraint? Because I found chapter two having some uncomfortable reading in it. It's highly philosophical, which I didn't expect, actually. I thought this might be historical and social, potentially political, financial. I didn't expect the layers of philosophy that you applied in there. But I do want to bring up this point around freedom, because you spend all of chapter two talking about it. And you particularly challenge to the reader of the idea of what freedom really is. And many of us associate having the freedom to go anywhere we want on our own terms with the car. But I'm going to read a quote from chapter two and ask you to tell our listeners what you mean by this. You say, larger systems are about inequalities of power and resource. They're also about variation in the way people and groups are recognised and valued. Can you tell us what that means in the context of how people sit into a vehicle in the morning, get to their place of work or school or wherever else? How did you connect philosophy and car ownership?
It was really the starting point of the book. So my background as an urban designer and as an entrepreneur, and my co-author, Professor Henrietta Moore, is an amazingly eminent and distinguished philosopher and anthropologist. So as you say, definitely not an obvious place mm-hmm. to start. You may think in terms of a book about cars, but we really use the car as a vehicle, as it were, to discuss a whole bunch of much broader and richer points around what is freedom in the 21st century, and critically, how does it differ from freedom in the 20th century? So the 20th century kinds of freedom were much more around convenience. What can I get out of the situation? How do I get from A to B as convenient as possible? And it's quite narrowly focused around my freedom in the moment to be able to do these things. And what we try and do, and what Henrietta has done, I think, really well in this book, Roadkill, is that she's broadened that definition of what is freedom. So might it be freedom to, you know, not die in a car accident, which is up until about 30 is the most likely cause of death? Is it the freedom to be able to breathe clean air? Is it the freedom to be able to not have to spend the largest portion of your income on after housing on cars? Is it the freedom to have an option other than just driving to be able to get around your city?
And so what we're saying, if I could just jump in there, because I want to take the first two points and then I want to take the second two that you said, because they're markedly different. The first two, this was the uncomfortable reading bit, is that I was reading this and I thought, well, of course I can. Like, of course I'm choosing to breathe the air that I want, etc. It was just interesting when you compared car ownership around the world. And you pointed out how typically people who own cars are in the Northern Hemisphere because people in Global South can't. So therefore, since cars are the greatest emitter of pollution, and of course we're talking about diesel engines there as opposed to electric, and we'll get to that. So therefore, by my choice of choosing how I might move around is influencing, we'll say, the air quality and other climate change implications of people in the Southern Hemisphere. What I felt uncomfortable about in chapter two is how Dr. Henrietta arrived at the conclusion that are we prioritising different people's lives according to different priorities and perhaps in such a way where they don't make that choice themselves?
That's exactly right. When we go into specific detail on this when we're talking about electric cars as well, in terms of some of the complexities over the mining supply chain, because the car industry and what we call the car industrial complex has basically said that cars are fine. All you got to do is change the fuel source. And if you care about the environment, then all you need to do is flip it from oil, where almost all oil is used in cars, to electric. And therefore, you're a goodie and you can keep driving. And what we try and show in the book and unveil is that actually the supply chains of electric cars are really, really, really damaging and use, as you say, a very similar model of green colonialism, an extractive model of capitalism, of going into countries, taking their natural resources. In the 20th century, that was oil. In the 21st century, that's rare earth metals. The reason that Donald Trump, amongst others, are very excited about getting their hands on Angola, on Greenland, on various other places around the world, on Ukraine, and various other places around the world, is not because he just fancies having a crack at it because he wants to build his empire, but because they've got very important rare earth metals, which are the critical ingredient of these batteries that power our electric cars. So there's a whole bunch of things in terms of structural inequality that we're pushing that happens not just, you know, domestically in Ireland, but actually all over the world as well.
Okay. And I want to go to the third point you made there around freedom, which is, can I have the choice to spend the money that I want on a car? And again, particularly as we moved into chapter three, I found myself saying, of course I do. And I still think that even after reading it. But I do want to share some numbers with our audience today and ask you for your elaboration on this. You said, in the UK, you say, drivers pay on average $9,400 a year on their cars, and $565,000 over a lifetime. That's calculated over 60 years. In the US, they spend $764,350 over their lifetime. So the point you're making there is that it's a big financial decision, number one, to learn to drive, and number two, to get a car, because if you get one, you'll probably keep having one. And then you looked at this in Germany. You said if an unskilled worker bought a small car, it would amount to 36% of their lifetime earnings. And indeed, in the aggregate, they are huge numbers. So how do you feel people should think critically then about either deciding to drive themselves or get a car themselves, or introduce that into their children's lives as well?
Well, the main thing is we want people to have the freedom to choose. Because what happens is that people chronically underestimate the cost of car ownership, and they roughly by 50%, so they think it's roughly half it. Well, and people fixate on the ticket price of the car. You think about cost of driving is, does that person have an expensive car or a less expensive car? And actually what we show through this detailed analysis of costs of driving is that the ticket price is one element, but actually it's really, you should be looking at it as the cost of becoming a driver and what that costs over time. So in Ireland, the cost of, over the course of a year, costs around €10,373, according to the AA, in terms of domestic figures. And critically, what we look at is that extrapolating that out over a 10, 20, 30 years of driving. I mean, I'm Irish. I don't sound it, I know, but I am a proud Irish passport holder. My grandmother, who lives in Dublin, has driven for nearly 70 years. And the cost of her driving over a lifetime will have cost her well over €1 million. And it's that kind of piece in terms of, she has never, and there's no reason she particularly should have, but she's never sat down and done the calculations in terms of, can I make this decision some point in the 1950s to become a driver?
But I'm guessing too, if she's after spending €1 million, has she, it sounds like she's got a nice car there, Arthur, has she?
No, she drives a small Honda that's about 15 years old. But the whole point is that, and what we show in the book Roadkill, as you say, is that over the course of time, these numbers add up massively. And the opportunity cost is also something that should be taken in there. And what we try and argue in the book is that the first freedom should be the freedom to have the information to make your decision. So if you love cars and you love driving, 100% spend that money on a car. It sounds like that's part of what we call in the book your rich life. So that's really important to you personally. For a lot of people, that is not the case. So I drive, as an example, but I drive sometimes as an obligation and as a last resort versus, and a lot of people also drive as a last resort because they don't have good alternatives and good other options. But what a lot of the time happens is people think, okay, I'm going to buy a car. I don't really want to, but I need to because I've got to get around. And they don't really make the full cost in terms of what that adds up to over time and what they could spend that money otherwise, because it could mean the difference of owning a home and not owning a home.
Now, you really do, again, present this in very stark terms. You say it could be the difference between owning a home or not. You say it could be a difference between funding education and not. Even you go so far as to say it could be the difference between people's affordability and having more children. And there's one area I disagreed with you, and I'd like to ask you out straight about this. And that is, you ran an opportunity cost analysis where you said, if you were to take the price of a BMW and buy a BMW, you have a declining asset. If, on the other hand, you were to put that money into the stock market, look where it would be. And I just thought to myself, but it's not like I can just put money into a BMW and then not, because I broke my foot, Arthur, in 2018 and I spent a year on crutches, right, where the choice was taken away from me about whether I could drive or not. The answer was I couldn't, of course. I spent a fortune on taxis, a lot of time waiting around for public transport. And so therefore, I felt that analysis was incomplete. Because it's not just, do I have the money to put into a car or not? If you don't, then you're going to spend time and money in getting yourself around. And particularly as someone, as I say, who had the choice taken away from me, I know that that can be expensive too.
No, I think that's a really, really valid point. And I think there's a piece here around people who have challenged mobility generally, of which you obviously were for that year.
Period of time, yeah.
What we're arguing for, to zoom out from that specific point, is saying that because of the way we've designed our cities in the last 70 years, so we argue the car industrial complex came into force since the end of the Second World War. So beforehand, what there were a range of different transport options that people had, and they were genuine alternatives. So one of the things I do is I sit on the board of directors of Transport for London. And what we try to provide in a city like London we don't always achieve this, but what we try to do is provide genuine, safe, reliable alternatives that are affordable to driving. So we want to say that you wake up in the morning and you need to get from A to B. You have multiple genuinely good options that are affordable, safe and reliable to get you there. What a lot of the time happens is that, and what we, when we say people are locked into a car dependent model, is that there is, when you cannot drive, as you couldn't for this period of time, is that you were not offered by, in this case, your government or your local community or the local transit, a genuine, affordable, reliable way of getting around it without the car. And that's what we mean by car dependency, is that you couldn't do that without it, and therefore you end up sending a fortune of taxis and equivalents. And so there's a, this is not anything that sounds like there's a Gordian knot saying you are, and we're definitely not saying this, that you are a bad person if you drive, or we're not saying that, you know, you should just, you know, get on with it and find a way to walk, you know, 20 kilometers a day or something ridiculous like that. This is a thing that's going to take a long time and thoughtful planning, really ambitious politics, communities to come together to find some of these solutions, because it's not going to be just like you switch one, switch for the other and off you go. I mean, one of the things we were honored and lucky enough to do the other day was to go on the radio in Texas. And we were talking to a gentleman in Dallas and various other places around Texas. And you can't think of a, I can't certainly think of many more car-centric societies than Texas. And one of the people who dialed in said, I live in a, I live in out, you know, 2 hours outside of the nearest city. I'm a farmer. I need a truck to get around. And the our answer to that, you know, what do you expect me to do? And our answer to that was, yes, you do. We are not saying no cars. And it's about providing genuine alternatives for people to have.
And given your background as an urban planner, it's interesting to hear where you're coming from on that. I will tell you, it's something you mentioned there a couple of minutes ago about the Gordian knot. You introduced me to that in the book. I found that very interesting to see, and I did try to unknot it. There's loads more I could talk to you about how US car debt is larger than the economy of Saudi Arabia, Turkey or Switzerland, how no more than 5% of cars are in use in the UK at peak times. Lots more we could talk about. But for anybody who would like to look at this in further depth, take a look at Roadkill, unveiling the true cost of our toxic relationship with cars. And believe me, you'll get a philosophy lesson as you do so. Thanks so much for joining me, Arthur.
Real honour to be on. Thank you very, very much for having me.
Now, I want to give you the answers to my economic trivia. So there was a global conference for industry clusters held across the island of Ireland last week, and I had the honour of emceeing or hosting it. And so earlier on in the show, I asked the questions, how many hotel bedrooms are available across the island of Ireland? And the answer is 74,133 rooms. And second, which is longer, the Wild Atlantic Way or the Great Ocean Road in Australia? By far, literally, it is the Wild Atlantic Way, which is the longest coastal drive in the world. There you go. So that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Ace Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. Now, I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. And please do forward it on to your WhatsApp groups as well to anybody who you think might be interested in listening to us. Now, Taking Stock is also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer is John Fardy, and on research this week was Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
3 employees and 2 work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.